Well, welcome everyone to another episode of I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist. Troy, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Had a great weekend. Everything was wonderful. What about you?
I don't think that's true. You've had a little bit of a health glitch, but it's all about getting old and you're just accepting that with grace, aren't you?
I am. It was a bit of a health scare. It hasn't been properly diagnosed yet, but it looks like it's not going to be a huge big deal, which was good. I had a little bit of paralysis in my foot and I've got this thing called drop foot, which is a nerve pinch. And I guess, and I say this for the sake of our Gen Y millennials and all those sort of youngins, play amongst yourselves while I say, for those of us that are Gen X and older, this is kind of getting old. I think just your body starts to give out in certain ways. And that actually brings us to today's session, by the way. Not that we have to get there right away, but old age, sickness and death, that's a very Buddhist thing that you have to sort of accept it like tide. You can't hold it back. So anyway, it is what it is, and on I go. And what about you though, Brian? How's your week, your weekend?
It's been busy. Like the last few weeks been crazy, crazy busy. I have quite an elderly mother. She's coming up to 87. Lots of needs at the moment. She's transitioning to full-time permanent aged care. She's been in hospital on and off for months, and there's a lot of transitional stuff that I'm assisting her with. So it's a bit tough, actually. It's been like working two full-time jobs for quite a while now in assisting her and helping her. And I also feel like it's a bit of karma for me because it's my behavior as a teenager, I think, is coming back to haunt me because my mum's behavior has become like a teenager. And it's been interesting. So anyway, not a great deal of fun, but I'm hoping that secular Buddhism can help me. So that takes us to today's guest, Troy.
It does take us to today's guest, but I just wanted to note, did you say the word karma on purpose? Because you also tied it back to this episode. Was that on purpose or was that just natural?
It was just natural. I'm a karma kind of guy, a karma chameleon.
Oh, are you? Yeah. I did see Culture Club when they came recently to Australia and my brother looked at me funny and it's like, no, I just really like them. Anyway, Ted Meisner is an executive director of the Secular Buddhist Association, a trustee on the board of the Mindfulness Network, and the host of the Secular Buddhist Podcast. His career, like me, was in IT for a really long time, but he changed careers in 2015, which is about when I jumped into IT. So maybe I took your place in the grand scheme of things. He became the first full-time mindfulness teacher hired at United Health for a team called Moment Health. His interest is in examining the evolution of contemplative practice in contemporary culture, and he teaches several mindfulness courses along with mindfulness-based stress reduction. Ted Meisner from the Secular Buddhist Association, welcome to I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist.
Thank you so much, Troy. Good to see you and Brian, and I'm very glad to be here on your podcast. Really an honor to be invited. Thanks so much.
More than welcome. We're looking forward to it, Ted, because I think as we found out with this series that we're doing at the moment about alternate belief systems and alternate religions, all that sort of stuff, that we come into a lot of these episodes going, yeah, we've got a reasonably good idea, but I soon find out personally that I don't. And there's a lot of things that I haven't been aware of. So that's what I'm really looking forward to today is learning more. We asked this, Ted, of all our guests at the start, were you a teenage fundamentalist?
I was not, and I'm very pleased to be able to say that because I know the great pain and difficulties that has brought so many people who were raised in those kinds of conditions. I have always been an atheist. From that moment at about, I think, age six, when stepping outside the door of a family cabin, saying an expletive and not getting hit by lightning, that pretty much settled it for me. And so I've never really been in that kind of environment, but I know it exists in lots of places and there's so much harm that happens. So I'm hoping we can unpack some of that as well.
You can see that you were definitely influenced by the culture though, the Christian culture, Ted, because you think that the God of the universe was actually concerned with a six-year-old saying shit, fuck, or poo, which is really the micromanagement of Christian fundamentalism. So yeah, you obviously did at least brush it in some sense. I know this is a big ask, but can you give us a brief introduction to historical Buddhism, maybe the major schools, thinking about people that don't necessarily know what it's all about, or like Brian and I think that we do and perhaps don't?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And there is a lot there. So understand this will be very broad brushstrokes. Buddhism started about 2,600 years ago in India, the Indus Valley. There's a person named Gautama who is a teacher, and he was born into a position of privilege and wealth. And so the story goes, at some point in the middle of his life, he really focused on contemplative practices, and in that formulated a way to, because this was the golden chalice of the time, is how do we end suffering? How do we extinguish suffering? And the idea was that here's how you can do it, is in your hands. It's not a matter of sacrifice, which was another way of doing things at the time, was a matter of working on yourself. And there are several different branches of Buddhism. I'll go into those in a moment, but essentially what we all share is that there are what are called noble truths about the world, which is a grand way of saying these three things. Stuff happens in life that we don't always like. There is distress and suffering and unpleasantness. There's also things that are not permanent. Stuff is always changing all the time. And there's nothing we could point to as a continuing self throughout the ages. So with those, and I'm translating that for a contemporary Western thinking, science-minded audience outside of a religious context. Otherwise, I'd be using words like anicca, anatta, dukkha, and that's what we're doing here. So main branches in Buddhism, three main branches today, and I say main branches because there are lots of different denominations within them. One is Theravada, and this is kind of old school Buddhism. It traces itself back to Gautama and the Pali Canon, P-A-L-I, Pali Canon. That is essentially the text from Gautama's talks at the time, from 2,600 years ago, and there's whole stories around that. Then there's also Mahayana, which is things like Zen Buddhism, is that branch of the tree. And Vajrayana, or what we might think of as Tibetan Buddhism. So those are those main branches, and I would suggest that because of its uniqueness, that secular Buddhism is an up-and-coming fourth branch to that tree. But that's the condensed version of what was Buddhism like. And I will say to add on to that, because you asked about historical Buddha and Buddhism, is that some of the older stories about the historicity of Gautama, is this a real person? Was this a made-up thing? It's like, yeah, it's actually confirmed by other traditions at the time, like Jainism does refer to Gautama. And likewise, in Buddhism, there are references to Mahavira, the founder of that religion. So there are external sources verifying this as well, and lots of other stuff going into it too.
Well, being a secular Buddhist, I guess for you, it doesn't matter quite so much about, you know, the
historicity. It's a tough one.
Historicity. So much about the historicity of it. I think it's interesting too, and I just want to make this point, Brian, before we ask our next question, is that there's so many different versions of Buddhism, even within those schools, just like there are so many different versions of Christianity. And so when you hear people coming from our Christian tradition saying, oh, I explored everything else and then I found Jesus. And it's like, no, you would have had to spend a lifetime just to explore one subset of one of these schools to be able to say you saw it from beginning to end. And I just think it's kind of interesting that, you know, from a Christian perspective, we think we know. We think we know what Buddhism is, or we think we know what Hinduism is. And oftentimes we really don't. And so in the same way that you think you know Christianity because you went to one Baptist church, that's not necessarily the case either. But anyway, that's my little soapbox moment.
And same in Buddhism, I will say that my first 10 years at a Zen center, when I first began contemplative practice, that wasn't representative of all Zen everywhere. I became very familiar with that particular kind in that particular place, the way that particular teacher taught it. And there's lots more to that, which is why you'll never be bored in exploring this if it's something that's interesting to you and you're getting some value out of it. And that's the important thing, because there are always some things that we need to be careful of and not giving up our own, well, our own choice about what we do as we explore, especially things that like fundamentalist religions that can be very difficult and has some challenges with it.
Yeah, well, fundamentalist Christianity is certainly an interesting system, because we did an episode, I think the first episode of this season, around certainty. And one thing with fundamentalist Christianity is you are certain. Like, there's 100%, this is the rule book, this is what I follow, this is a bunch of do's and don'ts and right beliefs, doctrines, creeds, all of those things that you line up, all those things that you have to believe. Is Buddhism like that, or is it, you know, is it about belief? Is it more about practice? How does Buddhism play out?
Yeah, such a wonderful question, I think, and is an appropriate one for any ideological stance one has, whether it's a spiritual tradition or a political belief or a scientific understanding, whatever it happens to be. I think a valid question is, how do we know this is so? How can you and I point to the same thing and have a similar understanding of it? So being able to question is a very important part of all of the different branches of Buddhism, not just secular Buddhism, that is throughout the tradition. And in fact, Tibetan Buddhism has an entire practice around Dharma combat, where they're asking questions about things and seeing how deep one's knowledge is. In Zen, in the ordination ceremony for a new reverend, a priest within the Zen tradition, the structure of that is people in the community asking questions and testing the knowledge and understanding and depth of practice and awakenedness, shall we say, of that individual. So it is very much encouraged. It's not a matter of, here's a doctrine you must adhere to with absolutely no evidence behind it or a paucity of evidence. Here's some ideas. Try them out for yourself. And this is one of the things that was always appealing to me about Buddhism as an atheist, as a Midwest American who's got a degree in biology and art science. This was always accurate and in alignment with what I would see in day-to-day life. Oh, shit does happen. Oh, yeah, I don't see a permanent self either. Oh, things are always changing. Yeah. And how do I put that into practice to understand how I am in this life better? That's really at the heart of Buddhism in all of the traditions, but it will take on different forms. Tibetan Buddhism is very much influenced by the Bon religion in Tibet at the time when it got there. So it looks very, very different than a more ascetic kind of Zen simplicity practice, which is in turn very different than a Theravada practice. So coming around circle to your initial question, yeah, questioning is encouraged, and genuine questioning with good teachers. They will always want to have you exploring, what does this mean to you? How do you know this is so? Always check that.
Generally, questioning in fundamentalist Christianity, you would be literally told that, oh, that's Satan whispering on your shoulder. That's the demons, and you know, you'd be praying against it, because you can't be curious. You can't ask questions about belief systems, because they've got it nailed. So it's refreshing to hear of an experience where you can go, I'm going to actually ask questions about this, and I'm going to work out what works for me best.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the podcast that I started, I was just taking a look of like, when did I actually start this thing? I found that one of the first few episodes, episode 4 or 5, something like that, was a recording of a talk that I was part of at a Christian college in Minnesota. And I was there with one of my Theravada teachers that I dearly love and is a brilliant, brilliant and wonderful man, Bhante Siwali in Minnesota, along with some people who were part of the faculty of that school. And it was interesting because it was a fun conversation, and the audience was very curious about what this Buddhism stuff was about and what meditation was about and all that. And sometime after, about a month after that, I found online that there was someone in the audience who wasn't part of that school who was much, much more fundamentalist than the people in the school. And I was very specifically called out as being very dangerous and under the devil's sway because I sounded rational and I had good reasons and good arguments. And that made me suspect and potentially evil. So it was, oh, that was a hoot reading that.
Yeah, well, great. And welcome to the podcast.
And I mean, that we heard that so often and experienced that if someone couldn't actually offer a valid counter argument, it's evil. Or if something was threatening, it's evil. It's a really easy and convenient thing in fundamentalist Christianity. You go the full othering, and anything other is evil. It was easy. You know, you don't have to be smart to be able to do that.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the joys about being in a tradition, because I do still have a foot in a couple of those branches, is that there's so much intellectual richness to them that it is something where what is said there has tremendous meaning and insight for what I encounter when I get stressed out or sad or happy or whatever it happens to be when I'm having a rough day. It's like, oh, you know what? This is that part. Oh, I get that now. That's a really wonderful thing to be able to explore that with my mind and heart and not because it was written down on a stone tablet.
So, Ted, let's get right to it. This is why we got you on this show. What is secular Buddhism?
So one of the interesting things is when this started, which is about, 15 years ago now, you mentioned when we were speaking before starting the recording about having read one of Stephen Batchelor's books. Stephen is a friend, and at that time, in about 2015, independently, we both happened upon this term, secular Buddhism, and for me, it was based on, I know I'm not quite any one of these pure things. It would be wrong for me to call myself a this kind of Buddhist or that kind of Buddhist or the other kind of Buddhist. It didn't fit. Not fitting was not a new experience to me. And wanted to start a podcast about something. I wasn't quite sure what. And I was like, oh, yeah, my encounter with Buddhism. What do I call this? Well, I'd had some familiarity with secular humanism. Oh, there we go. Secular Buddhism. And so started the podcast, The Secular Buddhist, at about the same time that Stephen Batchelor was starting to publish works using that term. And so it's often who thought of it first, and Stephen will send people to me. And I was like, no, it was Stephen. And the reason I will say Stephen came up with it first, and I want credit where credit's due, is he had the domain name. Secularbuddhism.org, which he gave to us to use. So he thought of it first. It's Stephen Batchelor. Now, as to what it is a way of exploring and embracing what the basic structures and practices of what we know as Buddhism, how they can be incorporated into this lifetime and what they may mean to people who are not a part of or interested in appropriating someone else's culture. I'm not Tibetan. I'm not Japanese. I'm not Indian. I'm something else. And my worldview is radically different than the people who formulated those particular traditional values in those times and those evolutionary progress, because one did build off the next. So secular Buddhism is a bit more democratic, a bit more inclined towards that questioning of how do we know this is so? What are you encountering? And also has the awareness of your experience, your lifetime, all the nuances of who you are different than anyone else. You're unique. And so what is most helpful to you in your life might be a little different than a rigid set of thou shalt nots or thou shalt. And so with secular Buddhism, and when we started the organization around it, one of the things that became a hot topic for us was, well, what do we exactly mean by this? And people kept asking, you know, you need to put out, what is your doctrine? And there was an insistence that it be this thing that's chiseled again in stone. And I'm like, no, that's not what we're doing here. This is a bit more open, a bit more democratic. And these tenets, these ideas of what we see with Buddhism, yeah, that's an accurate reflection of what our experience in day-to-day life is. I don't need to convince you. You know this for yourself. And we can come up with this examples of things like suddenly needing to go to the hospital, having a medical thing come up that touches all of those different areas of those noble truths. So practicing and ways of living, that's really what secular Buddhism is about. I just had an email today from someone saying, how do I become a member? And I, you know, my heart breaks a little bit and I'm so happy to get these at the same time. And I say, yeah, this isn't really about joining anything. It's not so much about identity. It's about what is helpful to you. What are you encountering in your life? And that usually ends the email conversations at that point. Because it's not easy, because that involves doing the hard work of taking a close look at who we are, at how we are, and the complexities of what's going on in life.
It's interesting because I read Stephen's book some years ago, but one thing that stood out to me at the time was the impact of liberal Christianity and the movement of liberal Christianity on what he was trying to explore with Buddhism. And basically looking at how sort of modern radical liberal Christians, what we would call progressive today, were trying to remove Christianity from its cultural moorings and of the time, and remove Christianity from its supernatural cosmology and trying to draw the value out of it. And we have a lot of people in our audience that would be that kind of Christian now. But it was interesting that he looked at that and said, there's some value of that in Buddhism. And it's so how, Brian, we've been introducing and meeting people over the last number of weeks, how this progressive movement within all these different religions do in fact influence each other.
Exactly. And one of the things that I've been so fascinated to see is that Stephen's work has progressed, that he sees these four noble truths, because the fourth one is you can do stuff about this. You're not stuck. You can do stuff about this. He interprets these as calls to action. It's not something you look at a wall as ideas that you're supposed to absorb. It's how you live your life. And again, that can be really challenging because it means you got to roll up your sleeves and do the work.
Yeah, people love a rule book too. I mean, I think that's why fundamentalist Christianity had its place in my life to a certain degree. It's just like, okay, I just have to follow this until that gets a little bit tired because you lose yourself in it. So secular Buddhism sounds like you can still retain self. And I think that's attractive. It's certainly attractive to a lot of people, but I can see how it's unsettling when people go, but I want to join. I want to be part of something and I want a definition and I want that to be able to direct my life because they're looking for something.
Right. It's the tough thing. It's the, I have this structure. And if I've just left something that was part of my whole life, I'm used to having a structural template to help support me with this stuff. And so one of the challenges I see with people who are convert Buddhists are more challenged by this than any others because they've often left something that caused them harm. And they'll come into Buddhism like, oh, this seems much better. But there's still that need to have structure. There's still that need to have those boundaries and that firm list of here's what I do and don't. It just seems like these are nicer do's and don'ts than the ones that cause me harm. And that's the big challenge. Like, no, this is maybe dismantling that structure. And what's that like?
It can become very threatening, I think. I think it's very people's safety in that scaffolding, I think, is something that's very much anchored. Tell us about your journey with Buddhism. Like, I'm assuming that you didn't start off, or you've told us you didn't start off as a secular Buddhist. So, you know, how did you discover Buddhism and what did your evolution look like over time?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it continues. I'll be open about that. Yeah, I continue to read and explore and practice. In the early 90s, I had noticed that I was having great difficulty focusing. My mind was all over the place. And this was showing up in karate, where I was at the time. I just really was having a hard time. And a friend had mentioned, oh, I heard meditation is good for that. Maybe you should check out the Minnesota Zen Center, which was close by in this nice place that's been there for a long time. And I thought, that's sure worth a try. So I went to try meditation, see what it's like. And there's a small group, maybe 8 people there. And the person who, in fact, it was Dokai Georgeson, who's still a wonderful teacher that I've known for years, led that. He gave basic instruction, is just focus on your breath, see what that's like. It was 10 minutes in silence, which is kind of not how people do meditation these days. They download an app and they listen to a guidance, and that's a very different kind of thing. And it was horrible. It was the hardest 10 minutes of my life to that point, because I'd never taken a look inside my head. And it was really quite shocking in a number of ways. The main one was like, oh, that's why I'm distracted. I have so much going on up in those couple pounds of tofu in my skull. No wonder I can't focus on anything. It was also starting to show, here are some things about me that I don't like that I really need to change. It was like the light was turned on, Pandora's box was open, and I couldn't unsee what I was like. And so I started meditating on a regular basis there. And that progressed into being the person who rings the bell for sitting a couple nights a week, and more so to support myself and the people who would show up here as well. Was with Zen practice for about 10 years and then felt there was something I was missing. There was still more there, and I didn't know quite what. And then encountered Theravada practice, the Pali Canon, which is a lot. It's several times more text than in the Bible. And you know that there's a lot in there. The Pali Canon is much, much larger even than that. And that was fascinating because the bulk of the Pali Canon is talks given by Gautama. And for just delving a moment into the historicity again of that, is that we can be fairly confident about these being close to the actual talks given at the time, because it was an oral tradition over the first 100 years, but monks who went off and recited these, it wasn't like the telephone game where you say something to one person, to one person, to one person, and then by the time it comes around, it's completely different. This is done in a group. So when one person had a little bit of variation, they could correct that and have the, here's what was said, here's what we do, and memorized. So when they came back for the councils, they could recite this and find that, okay, yep, we're accurate. We know where we are. So, and eventually those got written down. But the insights about the workings of the mind, about how people are in stress, in sickness, in old age, in death, but also in joys, also in happiness. And that's something that doesn't often get a spotlight within Buddhism, because it's focused on the things people are scared about and concerned about, which is, oh, I don't want to get sick, I don't want to get old, I don't want to die, all that kind of stuff. But it can also apply to, hey, my kid hit a home run. Hey, I just got that new job. Hey, I just accomplished something wonderful. I can now play this musical instrument, whatever it is. That's there too. It's part of it. It comes with the practice. So I started learning from Bhante Gunaratna, who wrote Mindfulness in Plain English and a number of other books. He's out in this territory. I've done a number of retreats with him. And again, a brilliant, brilliant man. And started studying with Bhante Siwali in Minneapolis. Again, a dear and wonderful person. When I was in the hospital for cancer surgery, Bhante Siwali, Bhante Bishwakirti came and visited me. These are just dear, dear people. And then eventually I stumbled upon mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a program that was developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn at UMass Medical School in the late 70s. And this is really what I've been looking for, because I had started podcasting by this point and exploring secular Buddhism, a different way to be. And this had always struck me as a kind of a transitional fossil. I knew this was leading somewhere. It wasn't like where I wanted to land. I knew there was more evolution to happen. And mindfulness has been that. And it's informed by stuff that's in traditional settings, but it's also informed by neuroscience and group dynamics and contemporary teaching methodologies and a whole bunch of other things. So that's really where I spend most of my time these days. But those of us of an age who are senior teachers at this point and been doing it for a long time, our feet, our roots where we started were in traditions. And so that's very much a part of how we are. And some of us are good at questioning that and seeing which parts are simply things that we're holding dear and holding on to instead of letting go of and growing. And that's one of the things that I always use as an kind of an acid test is there room for innovation? Religion typically does not have room for innovation. But on the mindfulness side, yes, absolutely. So that brings us to today.
So Ted, I'm guessing there's a myriad of views within the organizations you're a part of and even amongst traditional Buddhists. So let me just ask you, how literally do you take the Buddhist writings and traditional historical claims of Buddhism? And does it even matter to a secular Buddhist?
Those are great questions, and understanding that within secular Buddhism, opinions vary because of that uniqueness I mentioned earlier. Let's take, for example, the Pali Canon. Again, tons and tons and tons of stuff. As an example for your question, one part of that is the Jataka tales. And these are essentially the Aesop's fables of Buddhism. And that's not entirely accurate, but it's kind of the ballpark. And these were cultural stories that were adopted into Buddhism. So things like talking bunny, talking birds, all that kind of stuff. Now, I don't believe in the literal events of that. I can be convinced otherwise. Give me a talking bunny, and then we'll go from there. But otherwise, I don't buy it. And I think that's a rational conclusion to reach. It doesn't mean, however, that those stories don't have really, really important things to say about behavior, about life, in the same way that Aesop's fables may have something to teach us about life. It's more so about, from a secular Buddhist perspective, not having to accept the literal word for word, and understanding that typically we see this as translations. Not a lot of us read and speak Pali. Pali is a dead language. It's been gone a long time. In fact, that isn't even the name of language. It's what do you get out of it? So from a secular Buddhist standpoint, if there is a particular talk that Gotama gives, and I don't recall the name of the sutta, but there was one that he gave that, unlike the others, which typically finish with people saying, wonderful, 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 that was great, I get it now, this is terrific, people left pissed off and disappointed. And to me, that was the biggest learning with that particular one, because it was people questioned their views and they didn't like that. So I think it's, what do you get out of it? What are the layers that you can see? And again, this is one of the fascinating things for me about so much of literature within Buddhism, is that there is so much there to learn from. Another example is the Terigatha, which is poetry from nuns. And their experience as nuns is very, very different than that of the male monastics in the Buddhist tradition. So what's to be learned from that? What is that like? So not so much concerned from a secular Buddhist standpoint, what's there, and not so much the literal word-for-word translations of it, but what is the meaning? What do you get out of it? That's more important.
Which sounds very progressive Christian as well, you know, like the stories of Jesus or the stories of creation, communicating the love of God, etc., but not necessarily literal miracles, etc. And I see you nodding your head there, Brian. I think you could see that as well. And here we go again with the connections of these progressive religions.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a common thread, which we certainly are discovering through a lot of them. And it is interesting to hear. But one thing that really, when I think about Buddhism, and I think many people think about Buddhism, it's the concepts of, you know, karma, enlightenment, rebirth, not being born again. Let's not get those confused. But rebirth and things like that. As a secular Buddhist, what do you do with those concepts? How do you interpret them? Are they something that are in the bin, or what do you do with them?
Yeah, it's a great question, because this one comes up a lot. And I will say that the idea of karma or kamma, Sanskrit and Pali versions of the word, is that even contemporary in some monastics don't quite get it. Many years ago, there was a tsunami in Sri Lanka, and there were monastics who were saying, well, this is because of karma, that this was a punishment for past lives, transgressions. And to me, that's like, well, hang on. First, blaming the victim. Let's set that part aside, because that's just reprehensible to do. But also, you mean to tell me that everybody there, including the children, everyone else, was a vile person who deserved to be drowned or whatever it happens to be? The way averages work, I don't buy that everyone was there at the same time. But okay, what's missing with that is the understanding that that's not really what karma is. Karma is based on one's volitional actions, not the stuff you accidentally do. So as an example, you swat a mosquito who's biting you, like, yeah, but you intended to do that. That would be one of the things that's a, okay, there's some consequences to that. Versus I sit down and I accidentally crush a bug I didn't even know was there. That does not have karmic attachments to it. From a secular Buddhist standpoint, these ideas are actually very good. It's the idea that there are consequences to the actions that we take. That's a wonderful underlying message that allows us to pay closer attention to that thing we're about to say that maybe we shouldn't say, and that there are practices within Buddhism and outside of Buddhism now especially that help us to pause, relax, open, take a moment before we speak, and find a little bit of equanimity before we do that kind of stuff. And things like rebirth, again, this idea of we're related to everyone, everything. Okay, setting aside some of the challenges that I see with that, the idea that someone I'm about to have an argument with, what if I took on the perspective coming from karma that this is someone that I care about, that they are of value as a person? I think that's a good doorway to care and understanding and kindness that karma can open with that kind of way of looking at it. If that opens a door to greater compassion, wonderful. For others, yeah, I don't really need to think that you were my parent, love, child, whatever, in a past life for me to treat you with respect. So they do, I think, have tremendous value. And honestly, the stories are just plain interesting to read because there's so many layers. It's not just one thing that any one of the stories shows. It's not one story is about one thing. It's this multi-layered effect.
Ted, you told us before that people want to join secular Buddhism. And whilst I'm sure that there is a community aspect to this, at the same time, you're saying, hey, it's not something that you really join. So thinking about that, is there things that you use to exclude people from secular Buddhism? And what I mean is, what if someone comes along and says, hey, I don't know what I think about the afterlife, or I don't know what I think about reincarnation or, you know, enlightenment or rebirth, but I want to connect with secular Buddhism. Is it a spectrum? Do you allow people in, or is it like those atheist organizations that says, no, you must not believe these things, very different to the Christian, or very similar to the Christians who say, you must believe?
Yeah, and no, we're very open with that. And what I will often do is ask, what's your interest? What is it that's bringing you here? And what often comes in is, I've been dealing with a lot of difficulties in my life, and I'm not quite sure what to do with it. What I hear with that, what I get out of it is, I always confirm this with them, it sounds like the standard coping mechanisms you've had are maybe not doing the trick. Yeah, okay. Well, this can be helpful in that way, and it doesn't have to be this. And I make sure that there's an understanding. It doesn't have to be Buddhism. It can be therapy. This is not a replacement for seeking professional help if that is the appropriate choice for you in this moment. It may be that, oh, I'm interested in meditation. I'm not so much interested in Buddhism. Like, that's okay. Here are resources for you that are not about a Buddhist interpretation of these different kinds of meditations we'd find even in secular programs like MBSR. There's so many different ways to do a body scan. And some of them are very traditionally Buddhist and some of them are not. So really, so much of those kinds of questions when they come up is, what's bringing you here? What is it that you're hoping to have come out of this? For some, it's, yeah, I want to be part of a group. I'm interested in Buddhism. I like Buddhism. I've been doing this for a long time. And this just seems like a better fit for me. Okay, great. That's wonderful. I do mentoring and for different people based on what their interests are, their needs are. For one person, I'm very much recommending different Buddhist retreat centers and different Buddhist teachers and ways of interpreting that's appropriate for what they want to do. And for someone else who's coming in, not going anywhere near that. That's not what their interest is. That's not what would be helpful to them. For them, it's different things, different contemplative practices. What are you encountering and what is it that's bringing you here?
It's a lot of similarities with humanistic elements, isn't there? I mean, it's very, I work for a humanistic organization, and these are the sort of things that we actually talk about. We deliver lots of therapies, but it's very much the person is the center of the narrative, and talking about them being the expert on their own lives as well, and knowing the depth of what they need to actually tap into to best help them might not be the same as person B sitting next to them.
Yeah, exactly. And I've given several talks to secular humanist groups. That's kind of the thing here in the United States. There's many organizations across the country on that. And the way that I tend to characterize that in these talks is I'll refer to the Secular Humanist Manifesto. And what I say is contemplative practices are the how do we get there? Because that's the thing that I'm missing from that manifesto is like, those are great ideas, but you don't give us anything about how do we get there. That's what this is, training to grow your heart, mind, to be able to reach what is of interest with that manifesto.
It's there, like listening to you, you know, I mean, certainly the similarities with humanism. Humanism certainly doesn't believe in anything outside of this world that we're in now. Is that the same with secular Buddhism? Is there any spiritual elements to it, or is it more just centered in humanistic principles?
Yeah, and again, another great question because of the variety of how secular Buddhists tend to be. That may not be how it looks to others on the outside. So what I mean by that is, I don't know of many, if any, secular Buddhists who hold with supernatural beliefs, the unseen. It's what's here right now, show me. what is that like? And yet, when I sit behind this screen that you guys see on camera right now is where I sit and do my meditations every day. And I have incense there, I have a cushion there, and it looks like a space of a spiritual practice. It's not. It's all based on what gets me into a frame of mind of calm and safety and presence and alertness. That's what that helps me with. I've also got my flute there, but people tend not to know, oh, that's where you play your musical instruments. I'm like, oh no, that's where you get your Zen on. I'm like, yeah, okay.
So, what sort of pushback then do you get from more traditional Buddhists? Do they think that you have somehow betrayed true Buddhism, that you aren't real Buddhists, or do you have great relationships with traditional Buddhists, or is it a spectrum again?
Yeah, it's a spectrum. And I'll say that overall, the vast, vast number of Buddhists of all different traditions and none are like, this is wonderful, totally get it. There's nothing you're doing that is harmful or contrasting to what we do. We understand that you're doing something different. That's fine. That is welcoming. And again, this is so with my teachers in traditions. They have been the most supportive in all of this. And there are also others who see it the way you described of, no, it's being watered down. It's a perversion. You're a spin doctor and much worse things. And I've occasionally gotten into some tussles online with, well, you know, all of this stuff was said by a particular individual in a traditional setting. And here's where they got it wrong, because they didn't ask. They just said what their opinion of something was without even trying to understand. What are we doing here? Because we're not taking away from your setting and what you're doing. And the concern is, well, this is a perversion. This will water down for these wrong-headed ways. I would ask, well, what exactly is the part that you're concerned about that's being watered down? That we don't believe in talking bunnies? Or that maybe there's another way for people to be present and encounter the Dhamma? That's where things get interesting, because then we can have a conversation on it. the people who seem to have had the most difficulty are those, and this, again, this is not for everyone. This is just some that I've noticed this tendency is those who are convert Buddhists, typically Westerners, who came from a tradition that caused harm, and then they found Buddhism. And it has been a vastly different and more beneficial to experience for them, but there's still that tight clinging on to structure. And that this is different than that threatens that thing that they have found to be of such value that they have to fight against it. And I get where they're coming from. What I would ask is, let's talk about it. I want to hear what about it is causing you pain, in the same way that I would ask someone who is opposed to LGBTQA plus communities being together. Like, I'm sorry, how does that cause you pain? Let's have that conversation.
Oh, I don't know, Ted. Sounding like a communist now. Going to have to cut this interview off, I'm afraid. Ted, I have lost friends, quite literally, when I pushed back on the idea of talking snakes within Christianity. So when you say, well, you know, what's the problem talking bunnies, haha, I've lived it. I've lived that from a Christian perspective. Ted, I want to sort of wrap up now because we've been talking with you for quite a long time, but there's just a few more questions, if you don't mind, that we'd really like to ask, because these are the things that are kind of going to matter to our audience. What does secular Buddhism have to say about social justice? And you've started to touch on this in your last response. Are secular Buddhists active in this space? But more importantly, are secular Buddhists active as secular Buddhists in this space and not just something that sort of the individuals do outside of secular Buddhism?
Yes, some are and some aren't. It's a great question. I think Buddhism itself, particularly in the West, is shifting, where social issues, which typically this is the kind of stuff you're supposed to be letting go of to end the rounds of rebirth, is you are not attached to stuff that's happening in samsara, in conditioned existence. So seeing that shift of monastics marching in protests, things like that, that's great. Bernie Glassman and Zen in New York and their active social work. Yeah, there's more of that. That is happening more and more. Now, within secular Buddhism, it depends on the person. Some of them are like, no, I'm very private with my practice. I'm an introvert. I'm not much of a joiner. That's one of the appeals of this to me. Others are much more socially active. What we share is an understanding that how we are and what we do connects out to a lot of stuff. It's not just I can sit alone in my meditation space. Like, yeah. And there are practical things like there. If you don't go and vote, if you don't say yes or say no to some injustice that's going on, that has an effect on things and more as time goes on. So we all understand that there are impacts of that. Some of us take more action than others. And again, we have the openness to not get fully engaged because we're not all signing on to change the world.
So if you were talking to someone who was exploring different expressions of spirituality or trying to center themselves in something, and they've come to you and going, okay, what does secular Buddhism offer me in the 21st century? What would you say to them?
I would ask them about their experience first before I say, here's what secular Buddhism has, because I don't know where they're coming from yet. And part of this is the IT background and being a business analyst. And it's like, what's the problem we're trying to solve? What are you running into? So I want to have a conversation to get an understanding of what are they running into first before I say, ooh, secular Buddhism is a thing. I don't care if they engage with secular Buddhism or not. What I care about is how are they living their life in a means that's helpful to them. I have people who come to my mindfulness courses who are concerned because, well, you do mindful movement and that seems like yoga and that's against my religion, which I question. I don't find that to be the case. I'm like, we don't actually do yoga. I'm not a yoga teacher. We do pay attention to raising our hands over our heads and lowering them. Yoga doesn't own the patent on that. And Buddhism doesn't own the patent on focusing on your breath, for example. So what I do is ask them, what are you encountering? Because often what I'm going to say is therapy, if they're in severe dysregulation. I'm going to say, well, you might want to try a couple meditations and see what that's like and let me know how it goes and then let's adjust. And I might say to someone who's like, yeah, you know, I tried Zen and here's some problems I had. And I tried this other thing. It wasn't quite right. I'm like, well, take a look at our site. Take a look at the Secular Buddhist Network. Get to know some of the people there. Have conversations. Ask questions. Learn about it. And make a decision about what the right fit is for you. And I'd say that itself is one of the advantages that we have to offer is do your own exploring. Learn if this is the right fit for you. Because we're not trying to convert people.
Ted, let me drill down on that as sort of our last question. So tell us about the Secular Buddhist Association. What is it seeking to achieve? What does it offer? What's it doing for people? Why does it matter to you to be a part of a group?
Well, interestingly, I did not want to start the organization. My colleagues and some of the first people who, some of the first guests on the podcast, this needs to be an organization because secular Buddhism is so new. This is a pivotal change and, you know, a new branch of the Buddhist tree. If it doesn't get some grounding for that seed to grow, it's going to die out pretty quick. So there needs to be some place for people to go to learn more about that than just randomly picking it up through Stephen's great books or various podcasts or things like that. So we started an organization, and it was very much based on community, having discussions, and learning about what this might be without setting here's the firm set of what our ideological stance is. So the organization since then has grown. And what I'm very happy to see is that there are more organizations in other places. In fact, in Australia and New Zealand are some really terrific actions happening in secular Buddhism there. There are now several books that have the word secular Buddhism in them. And again, the Secular Buddhist Network, which is another group of people that I know, they're doing so much activity and having regular articles and things like that. It's done more than I ever foresaw. So I've been able to shift my focus more into the mindfulness sphere, knowing that this is in good hands. And it's now going to continue, whether people like it or not. Secular Buddhism is something that's here to stay. It's always interesting for me to hear from people saying, oh yeah, I'm a secular Buddhist. I'm like, really? How long have you called it that? Because typically they've been doing and being the ways that secular Buddhists might describe it without really thinking of it that way. It was just, oh yeah, I'm in this center or that place or that vihara. I've just always felt a little different about it. Secular Buddhism. Okay, great.
Well, Ted, it's been wonderful chatting to you today. And again, as I said at the start, I have learned a bucket load. So I've loved it. And because I do have a little bit of a conniption when we talk about spiritual stuff quite often, today I haven't had a conniption. So I am loving that.
I'm glad it was a conniptionless conversation for you.
Yes, no, it was. It is wonderful. And it's wonderful just to see the similarities again with so many of the things that many of our guests have been certainly discussing with us over the last few weeks. I've loved it, Troy. It's been a great chat, hasn't it? And I'm sure that you probably knew a lot of this because you have practiced Buddhism yourself for quite a long time.
Yeah, that's right. And someone said to me when I said, oh, I used to be a fundamentalist Christian and now I'm a Buddhist, they actually said, oh, that's just so cliched. And I'm like, okay, because I think a lot of us end up in this place. And but, you know, like Ted said, I'm actually part of I'm actually a member of a temple here that is not secular, that is actually more traditional. But it's a nice place and they don't care whether you actually believe cosmology or not. And I connect with that. I haven't been in a really long time, but this is just what it is. I remember when I started going along to the Buddhist temple, my wife being Chinese, I said to her, are you coming? She said, no. I said, that's it. I'm now officially more Asian than you are, as I ran off to my Buddhist temple. But yeah, it's definitely been something that's been meaningful for me. It ebbs and it flows in my life. There's times where I draw on it more and less. Things come in and crowd it out, and other times I stop and go, wow, you know, I need to focus it back in on that. But the thing that I've really enjoyed about this, Ted, is the openness and the freedom for people to choose their own expression and what matters to them. Coming from fundamentalist controlling high control groups, that's what our people really need to hear. And so, you know, that's really good. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us and to explain that. I'm sure that there are going to be some that are going to go say, nope, I'm not joining nothing. And there's going to be others that say, this is of interest to me. Maybe there's some value here. And so thanks for directing them. I'll make sure that I put the links onto the show notes so that people can click on that and find out all about Secular Buddhist Association. Ted Meisner, thank you so much for being a part of this today.
Thank you, Troy. Thank you, Brian, very much. It's been so much fun. Appreciate being with you.
If you'd like to connect with the I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist podcast, then please see the links in our link tree in the show notes. We invite you to join our listener community on Facebook, and we're also on Instagram, X, and Reddit. Check out our merch on Redbubble. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, mugs, and all kinds of great ex-evangelical stuff that you can wear proudly. All proceeds go to building and promoting the podcast. We want to give a huge shout out to our Patreon supporters. Subscribers get a range of benefits, including free merch, early access to episodes, access to our exclusive subscribers group, and monthly bonus content. Again, all proceeds of this go to the running and promotion costs of the podcast. A special thanks to Ava, who manages our social strategy, and also to Kerry and Bree, who manage our Facebook listener group, and also to Bree, who puts out our monthly newsletter on Substack. All of our episodes are transcribed by Leanne to increase accessibility. The show is produced and hosted by Brian McDowell and Troy Waller. The sound engineering for this episode was done by Jonathan O'Brien. I Was a Teenage Fundamentalist is available wherever you find your podcasts. Again, you can find all our links in our link tree in the show notes. Or why don't you pop across to our website at www.iwasateenagefundamentalist.com.